I'm very pleased to introduce to you our next speaker, Dr. Marion Howard. Dr. Howard's a professor in the Department of Gynecology and Obstetrics at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. She's also a clinical director of the Teen Services Program for Grady Memorial Hospital. She's been in these positions for about 20 years. And during this time, she's developed one of the most rigorously evaluated and successful teen pregnancy prevention programs in the country called Postponing Sexual Involvement. This program has received national attention, and it's one model program that's being promoted across the country. She's published 4 books on teen issues. She's authored 5 book chapters. She's written over 40 articles and monographs, primarily on teen sexuality and preventing teen pregnancy. Throughout her career, she's testified, participated in conferences sponsored by the White House, the U.S. Public Health Service, the U.S. Office of Education, the Departments of Health, Labor, and Education, the Centers for Disease Control, Stanford University, at Carnegie Corporation, in England, talking about implementing this program in British schools, and the list goes on and on. I'm very pleased to be able to present to you Dr. Marion Howard. I heard her present a couple years ago at the Society for Research on Adolescent Medicine. All I can say is that her presentation was just as impressive as her credentials. Welcome.
Try to live up to that introduction. I have to be very fast because we don't get much time up here, so I'm going to talk quickly. If I talk too fast, just raise your hand. I'll try to slow down. I have been interested in the problems that adolescents are having and living in this modern world for a great deal of time. One of the problems I have been most interested in is helping adolescents better manage their sexuality, because I do feel through my work is that once a young girl becomes pregnant, it can dramatically alter the rest of her life, and the same is true for the young man. So to make a long story short, when I had an opportunity to go to Atlanta and actually work in a community, I jumped at the opportunity, and I had a lot of theories and ideas, many of which I have since proven wrong. So I'm going to share with you some of the things that I learned that I thought I knew that I didn't really know. One of them was I firmly believe that no one operates intelligently in a vacuum, and so therefore knowledge is a beginning point in any behavior change. So I was so excited when I got to Atlanta and had an opportunity to work with Atlanta Public Schools, and they gave me 5 classroom periods to tell young people all they needed to know about their bodies, all they needed to know about human sexuality, anatomy and physiology of the reproductive system, and maturation, hygiene, sexually transmitted diseases, all those things you can get and what they do to you, teenage pregnancy and the problems that can cause. We took contraceptive methods right into the classroom and showed them how to protect themselves from all those things and talked about decision making. And I was an assistant professor and couldn't be wait to become an associate professor, and I evaluated the program. And you never read the study. I published it in Australia. And the reason I did that is essentially what I learned is that the kids learned a great deal, but it didn't change their behavior. And the reason I didn't publish it right away is, as I said, I'm a firm believer that nobody operates intelligently in a vacuum. If you don't know HIV/AIDS is out there, how are you going to manage your behavior to avoid it? So I didn't want the baby thrown out with the bath, but I didn't know what to do, and I was just kind of stunned. So I crept away for a couple years and thought about what was wrong. And one of the things I learned is that knowledge alone does not change behavior. I'm hiding behind this microphone because I'm 40 pounds overweight, and this morning I had one of those big sticky buns with all that frosting on it. You know, I know that was not good for me, but knowledge alone does not change behavior. And what I missed was just because you tell kids about fallopian tubes and ovaries and how the penis goes in the vagina and the sperm swims up, if they're in the back seat of a car with a boy and he says, even if you don't have sex with me, I'm not going to see you anymore, kids aren't thinking about fallopian tubes and ovaries and all that. They're thinking about the relationship, and I might lose this boy. And so what I thought is, what I had forgotten to do is look at what a given risk looks like from the point of view from the adolescent as opposed to the adults. Basically, kids are very concrete in their thinking at these younger ages. They don't have those formal operational thinking. Industry knows that. Nike doesn't sell its shoes because it's going to prevent ankle problems 5 years from now. You know, they sell them because you're going to be cool and you're going to run faster and jump higher and all this stuff. And we were trying to, you know, say to kids, oh, 5 years from now, you might have dropped out of school and have this baby, you know. And they're saying, you know, oh, this is the most wonderful boy in my life, or this girl is fabulous. Because they are such concrete thinkers, too, and don't have those formal operational thinking skills we all get later, the reality of the immediate, they're thinking about why I feel about this person right now, not how I'm going to feel about this person 3 months from now when the relationship breaks up, or 5 years from now. The same way is it limits their use of information. And that's what I learned, is that adolescents are not short, just short adults, that they haven't completed some of the most important phases of their growth and development in terms of, and I wish I had time to talk about their moral development, psychosocial development, their cognitive skills, and all these things. But if you say to a girl, gee, if you become pregnant at your age, you know, and you're so young, you could give birth to a low birth weight, prematurely born baby, have handicapping conditions like mental retardation. And they'll look at you and say, well, my girlfriend had a baby and there's nothing wrong with her baby, because that concrete reality is more real to them than any sense of probability or future. Another thing, because they are trying to distance themselves from their parents and become more independent, and that's a normal part of that middle stage of adolescent growth and development. In order to become independent, they need to push off. And that's how they use their peers as a lifeline to the future. My son was leaving to go to a movie with one of his friends. He's a teenager the other night, and one of the things that the other mom turned around and said to them is, have a good time. And his friend looked back, and he said, don't try to tell me what to do. So this is that stage where adolescents are trying to become more independent. And as such, they don't do very well with lectures with adults saying, you know, don't get pregnant, don't do this, you know, because they're trying to make their own decisions. Again, that's a normal part of adolescent growth and development. So we were just giving them knowledge and saying, don't do this and don't do that. Oh, I have to tell you one other joke, too. It's one of my favorite jokes. It's about two preschoolers who are talking. And one says to the other, my dad found a condom on the patio last night. The other one says, what's a patio? And the reason I tell that joke is because we do kind of think the kids know everything today. And because condoms are so much in the news, they know all about them and how to use them. But when teenage girls were asking what time of the month you most likely become pregnant, something like 98% said they knew, only 2% said they didn't know, 50% gave the wrong answer. And if it's something as critical as what time of the month you're most likely to get pregnant, and you think you have the right answer but you don't act on that, that can be bad. So for young people, their use of information is not the same. They don't have enough information. They're trying to become independent. They don't want to put up with adults in the same way. Then what happened to me is I came across something called the social influence model, and I actually saw that it was being used in the smoking field by Alfred McAllister. And essentially what he said is young people are more likely to engage in negative health behaviors more because of social and peer influences than lack of knowledge. In other words, most kids know that you can get pregnant. They may not know all the right things about how you do it, but they know you can get pregnant. They know AIDS is out there, there's been. But still, it doesn't guide their behavior. And what he says is basically social and peer influences. So I straight plagiarized McAllister's curriculum, with his permission, put it in the human sexuality field, although we had to change quite a few things. Like he said, go home and tell your parents not to smoke. Well, with sex, you know, there's things you can't do. But one of the stunning things about the social influence model is he says that messages that come from young people closer to their age are more likely to be powerfully understood by the young people. They're more powerful messages, and they have longer lasting results. And when I thought about it, I thought, gee, if I'm standing in front of a group of eighth graders and I say, well, if somebody says, have sex with me, I don't want to see you anymore, and I say to them, here's what I'd say. They'd look at me and they'd say, that lady ever had sex? It'd be 20 years ago. It couldn't have been any fun. Because they don't see their sexual lives as related to adult sexual lives. If you look at the media, who's having sex on the media? 94% of the sex in the media is among people who aren't married to one another. Because if you're married to somebody, you're always having sex with somebody else to get their vineyards, etc. And sex is primarily shown among people who are not only not married to each other, but generally unmarried, and often very young and attractive. Remember the Golden Girls? There was no one that Blanche had not done it with, right? Blanche had done it with anybody. But did you ever see her do it? No. You tell kids, grandparents do it too, and they say, oh, gross, oh, no. Because they don't see sexuality as something enjoyed throughout life. On television, it's shown among young people, and they're the ones having great sex, doing it, rolling off the bed, you know, having all the great sex. So kids get the very distorted impression about, like, sex is for the young, you got to do it now, etc. So learning from that, and what I also learned is that it's very important males don't have very many role models in our society about how to manage their sexual behavior. There's still a lot of messages that boys will do it, they'll sow their their oats, all that stuff. And so that for young men, there were no societal restraints on them. As a matter of fact, one of the problems in our society is we have removed all societal strain. Now people feel free. Anybody can have sex with anybody. You know, princes and princesses now do it, too. I mean, there are no role models anymore. I think we must remember back to the time of Roosevelt when other leaders around the world never knew that he was paralyzed because the media never showed him from the waist down. Now, the slightest sexual indiscretion, politicians, religious leaders, anybody, the media's fair game and headlines. We never say there are no headlines. So-and-so remained married and faithful to his wife for 20 years and had a great sex life. You know, you never see that. You always see the other side. So what we did is we took the social influence model, applied it to the human sexuality field, hired and trained 16 leaders, 11th and 12th grade students, to come down to the 8th grade to teach young people skills to resist social and peer pressures to become sexually involved. And I have a video right now. I'm going to take you inside of a classroom for 8 minutes and let you see how that works. Okay?
Teenagers have far more unintended pregnancies and abortions and catch more sexually transmitted diseases than any other age group. Many act as if they don't know contraception exists, and many don't. So even if we had new contraception methods, it wouldn't help young people protect themselves if they didn't know about these methods. Frankly, teaching anything about sex often makes us uncomfortable. And so the same polarization we saw in Washington goes on in our schools. But does it have to? Is there a way to teach contraception and still satisfy those who say, just say no? In Atlanta, they're trying to do just that. Atlanta is all about growth, but with local rates of teenage pregnancy so high, that's more growth than Atlanta wants. What's different is that in Atlanta, every eighth grader in public school must take part in an innovative program. Innovative because it teaches two messages, two philosophies. Say no to sex, but if you don't, here's what to do. Many people believe abstinence in teenagers is just about as admirable and just about as hopeless as prohibition. And so these teenagers are given direct, comprehensive instruction on how contraception works. And then, because the premise of the program is that eighth graders are too young to have sex, they couple this with 5 hours of teaching kids ways to postpone sexual involvement and reasons why they should, despite peer and media pressure to do otherwise. These classes in postponing sexual involvement are taught not by preachers or even teachers, but by teenagers, called teen leaders. Before they begin, they're trained in what to do, what to say, what not to say, and why.
We selected you because we felt that you would be a positive role model to the younger teens. We selected you because we felt that you were concerned about the problem of teenage pregnancy. You knew that it was a problem. You wanted to do something about it. You are in agreement that young teens should not become sexually involved, that they're not ready to handle the consequences or the responsibilities of what a sexual relationship does involve.
Just because you're curious does not mean that you have to go and experiment.
Twala Ellison, a veteran teen leader at work.
Things, sex from time to time, right? Mm-hmm. All right, and that's an important, really important to realize that there is nothing wrong with thinking about sex or being curious about sex, because sex is what?
Natural.
Sex is natural. But don't feel like because you think about it and you're curious about it that you have to act on it, all right? All right.
It's a simple message these teen leaders are asked to teach. Sex has consequences. The tough part is getting that message across to kids who may get to the point of having to decide whether to get an abortion without having been taught how not to get pregnant in the first place.
Much older than 7th, 8th, 9th grade. They don't think about birth control because I know for a fact if a 7th, 8th, or 9th grade student is thinking about having sex, they're going to do it in the littlest amount of time that they have, usually while mom's at work or something like that. They don't have time.
Same school.
Right.
they don't feel like they have enough time to be going through the proper procedures of making sure the condom doesn't have any air. You know, they're just thinking about doing it, getting it over while they have the time.
Most males don't believe in stopping the action, as some might say, to get up and get a condom. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
that's what the boys talk about at school. You know, you might be tripping, might be sitting down at lunch or something. They might be like, man, you know, I wouldn't mind using a condom, but... you know, I might have to start all over, you know.
Yeah. The girl might not feel like doing it if I have to get up, go to the dresser, get the condoms, and come back.
Or it's not easy, because when Ms. Winfrey first came to me and asked me if I was interested, the first thing I thought was, I cannot get in front of a classroom full of people and tell them don't have sex. But now, I don't look at it. I don't look at it as I'm saying don't have sex. Sex is bad. I think I'm saying now, if you're going to have sex, think about the consequences and the risks before you do it. And then by introducing them to some of them, giving them a chance to really think. Because I don't think a lot of teenagers think. I can't believe I said that. But I don't think a lot of teenagers think a whole lot.
But when you come in and you step off the pedestal and you talk like, yeah, I'm really interested in what you have to say. And you look at them straight in the face. They're like, oh, he really means it. And they know your name by the second session. They look for you to come back by the third. By the fourth, they're really into it. And by the fifth, they don't want you to leave.
Okay. Tony is over at Ann's house. And Ann's mom.
Marcus Everhart is another team leader here teaching by role playing.
And so she leaves Tony and Ann alone. And Tony starts coming on to Ann. And now, light.
Oh, I can't believe my brother. He left his shoes again. But that gives us enough time to go upstairs.
No.
No, boy, I thought you said you loved me.
I do, but I don't want to have sex with you.
I mean, what's wrong? Are you scared?
No, I'm not scared.
Then why are you tripping like that?
I'm just tripping, but baby, I said no.
Well, why you keep telling me no?
I don't like the way you make me feel, and I ain't gonna talk about it no more. Come on, Ann. How about you, me, a bucket of fried chicken upstairs? What do you say?
No.
Now, come on, Ann. You say you love me.
Pop, I do, but you're making me feel bad.
Come on, Ann. Your mom's going to be gone for an hour and a half. Come on, you.
Come on. You know you want it. You know.
No, I really don't.
Come on, Ann. No.
Come on, please. I want to show how much I love you.
No.
You said you love me, so why don't you do it?
I do, but I'm just not ready for it.
No.
Couple of minutes.
No.
That's all I need. Come on, couple of minutes.
No.
Come on, you don't mean that. Come on, let's go to your room. Let me show you how much I love you.
Why do you keep pressuring me if you love me?
Come on, Ann.
No. Say, if he can't take no for an answer, then you don't need him for a boyfriend. But remember, when you're up here and you're playing with one of us, remember, you like this guy because he's fine. Y'all been going together for a long time.
A lot of baby. You ready?
Camera, action!
Come on, man. Let's go to your room.
No. Wait a minute. No.
Come on, why are you laughing? You're not taking me seriously?
No. I said no. I mean no.
Come on, if you love me, you would.
Well, I do love you, but I don't want to.
Come on, you don't mean that.
No.
Come on.
No.
Okay, good. Okay, what did she do right? What didn't she do right?
She laughed.
She laughed and smiled, so you wouldn't think she was serious. Okay, would you think I was serious if I told you no and I was like, I was smiling when I'm trying to get serious. I'm like, no, no. Okay, would you take me seriously?
No.
These techniques.
And they don't want to hear the manual. They want to hear it coming from you. Like being black and being a teenager, they think they can trust you because they look up to you when you know that you can come with a positive message, that there's nothing wrong with saying no, that if you postpone on sexual involvement, you can better yourself by the decisions you make. You're taking control of your life. And we just don't want them to be at a disadvantage.
For this food we are about to receive for our body. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Amen.
Marcus, who grew up with his mother and their extended family, is active in his church, and he says His commitment to the Teen Leaders Program partly stems from his faith. But another part of it comes from his recognition of the special problems faced by young African Americans in our society. He sees this program as a way to empower them.
The only thing that makes the news about teen black males is that either they're being locked up on manslaughter or assault and battery, or either it's just something negative. That's what I'm trying to make a difference, because the role models I had to go looking for mine. My role models didn't, like, come up in shining armor showing me the way. We have to struggle to make our own way and then show our little brothers and our little sisters where to go.
This value-laden course in postponement has reshaped more than sexual attitudes. Consider Marcus and his girlfriend, Tia.
Before, I was just looking for a girlfriend, like, just to be there, just to be on my arm. When I go walking around, she had to look good. She had to, like, she didn't have to speak, but she just had to look good when we walked around. The teen service program has changed the way I look at relationships and the fact that I take them more serious. She comes to me with her problems, and we sit on the phone and talk at 3 a.m. And we've actually talked so much, we've actually cried on the phone. And she's telling me, like, some of her problems. It's basically, nothing big, but it's like just spending time together just keeps us happy. When I first met Tia, I told her that I walk what I preach. When I go around teaching them to say no, I wouldn't expect for someone I told to say no to sex if I wasn't doing it myself.
We don't have time to show you the rest, but I think you can see what powerful role models young men can be in the classroom as well as young women. After we evaluated the program again, having added these 5 classroom periods on postponing sexual involvement, which are essentially skill building about how to resist social pressures, those media messages they hear, how to handle relationships, levels of physically expressing affection in relationship, choosing a stopping point, being able to communicate to the other person what your stopping point is. After we added those, we found that young people who didn't have this program were as much as 5 times more likely to become sexually involved in the 8th grade. There was still a 1/3 reduction of sexual involvement in the 9th grade. We also found that of those young people who went ahead and had sex, they were more likely at the end of the 9th grade to say, I tried it once or twice, or I used to have sex, but don't anymore. We also found that they, because we kept our old part of the program, those 5 classroom periods of human sexuality, that they also were more likely to use contraception and to say it was because of what they learned in school. Although our numbers were too small because birth rates, as you just heard in the previous talk, are figured per thousands of women, it also seemed as if births, in the population we know, the births were reduced by 1/3. What I think my conclusion is that young people, nobody sets out to make a mistake. And what young people really want to do, what's going to be healthy and happy for them in the future, it's just often they don't have the skills to manage the world that we give them to live in. This is essentially a big people problem. It's our world that we give them. It's not a little people problem. But I think we can do a much better job in helping young people manage their sexuality if we're innovative and creative and reach out to them in ways that they can understand. Ultimately, I think what we have to convey to young people is 2 things. Is one, well, it's actually really one thing, that throughout life, people do 2 things. They either abstain or they protect themselves from consequences that they don't want to have. I mean, you can be happily married and madly infatuated with somebody in your office, but you abstain from having sex with that person. You know, your husband or wife goes off to Bosnia, and you abstain from having sex. We abstain. Somebody's ill in the family. You abstain. You abstain off and on throughout your life. That's a skill that people have and they use. The other thing they do is they protect themselves from consequences. If you're married and you don't want to have 12 children, you protect yourself from that consequence. so that all throughout life, people either abstain or protect themselves. For young people, the best choice is to abstain. They need to focus on developing their values, their skills, finding out who they are and where they want to go in life. And so if we can help them postpone sexual involvement until they're older and closer to a time when they are aware of who they are and what they believe and what they want out of life, that's best for them. But regardless, at an early age, we start to need to say, you know, your grandparents learned to manage their sexuality, and your parents did too. You can do this. We believe that you can handle your desires and your feelings about this, and you can learn to manage those in ways that will be right for you. So thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Questions for Dr. Howard? I see one in the back.
The question was really what kind of semantics do we use regarding contraceptives or basically protecting themselves. We have a new program coming out that we've done just that, and we talk more about, and the whole program is called Protecting Your Future, and you need to protect yourself from all these consequences and protect your future. So I think semantics is very important. That's why we say postponing sexual involvement rather than abstinence, you know, which is kind of funny. But kids can see, oh, postpone, that just means put off. It means it's not that I'm going to ever not have sex. I mean, I will have sex sometime, but I'm just going to put it off. So semantics are very important. The other thing is, as I said, young people don't do very well with lectures. So in postponing sexual involvement, the whole thing is experiential. The teen leaders are constantly leading discussions using very guided questions because everything is designed to help teens reach the conclusion that they ought to postpone sexual involvement. But questions like, well, what do you think about a boy who continues to pressure his girlfriend to have sex after she said no? And when the kids say, well, he's a turkey or he's a dork, or he's just using her, that comes from them. You're not saying that. Or what do you think about a girl that gives into when she having sex when she really doesn't want to? Well, she doesn't think very much of herself. She's just letting herself be used. You know, those things come through. It's all experiential, teen leaders guiding discussions and then role modeling themselves that you can be successful in the teen world without being sexually involved. And I think that role modeling is very important because kids have this idea, sort of like the parent survey, that everybody's doing it. But through a series of activities and exercises, we help them see that not everybody's doing it. And then they have these teens who say, look, yeah, you don't have to do it. I'm not doing it. The question is, how can I say that we can be certain of success in this area? We did a very uniquely designed study, and that we were most interested in the outcomes on low-income youth. And so, therefore, we took the birth records from the public hospital in Atlanta that serves the indigent population, took every single child who was born in 1972, matched it with current records to see if that child was still in poverty by virtue of the mother or the child having come to the hospital in the last 5 years, located all those parents whose children were entering the eighth grade, and then we asked them if we could call that child over 5 years because we tracked them 8th through 12th grade, and asked them a broad array of health questions, smoking, drinking, drugs, exercise, food habits, so kids had no idea it had anything to do with this program in the schools. And then we were also able to pull hospital records to verify, had this person ever come for a pregnancy test, had they ever had an abortion, had they ever given birth to a child, had they ever come for family planning, treatment of an STD. So I think it's a very sound study. And we saw that 1/3 of those births had been reduced. So I can say absolutely, among the low-income population we studied at a publicly funded hospital, we reduced births among those we studied by 1/3. Now, your good question is good. Is that generalizable to the rest of the world? If you put it in a high school where everybody's Harvard-bound with high SATs, would you get the same kind of difference? Probably not, because kids are different. In other words, those kids may not need this kind of program and may not be useful to them. Where that middle falls, how many you would get among everybody, I don't know. But I know among the lowest income, high-risk youth, it made a significant difference. Yeah, I think that's very important. I hope I said that throughout my presentation, that we continued the 5 classroom periods and we taught them all about how to protect themselves and contraceptives. As a matter of fact, our new program actually applies the social influence model to use of protection as well. But I do direct a family planning clinic for young teens, which is my concern about how difficult it is for them to manage the behavior. But so that we're in the schools and we are linked carefully so that young people can get those services. But I think the most critical thing is it doesn't relate to this program, but what you said about quick fixes. ultimately, as I said, it's a big people problem. It's our culture. It's us. It's we as adults and how we manage our sexual behavior. It's not a little people problem. And ultimately, until we fix what they see on television, until we fix what they hear about our behaviors, until we fix how we're willing to sacrifice ourselves as parents, you know, some of the things that our desires to role model for kids, we won't solve this problem. But in the meantime, till we get it all fixed, I think that there are meaningful things we can do for young people. There's so much room for growth and change. You're going to hear from Mary Vincent to say that there are many different approaches. No single solution is going to work for everybody and work for everybody over time. But as long as young people hear from many parts of the community that it's okay to sexually postpone sexual involvement, it's okay to protect yourself, and it's wise, and it's important, and it's good, and we applaud your protecting yourself from consequences, and support them in that, I think we can make a tremendous difference in their lives. The saddest thing is to have a young person come to you and say, if I knew last year what I know now, this wouldn't have happened to me. Somehow we have to get through to them in ways that are acceptable to them so those things don't happen to them. I wanted to comment, too. According to that same Guttmacher report, by age 19, 86% of males and 75% of females have had sex. By age 15, 33% of males and 26% of females have had sex. But one of the main changes is the percent of 15-year-olds having sex, that's females, increased 500% between 1970 and 1988. But I think what the implications for the family and for society that are most important is of those teenagers who give birth, only a third were unmarried in the 1960s and 81% were unmarried in the 1980s. You know, a third of marriages used to be shotgun marriages, whether you like it or not. Right now, there just aren't enough marriages to go around for those births, which is why we have this explosion of single-parent households and children who don't have the same traditional resources for support that they used to. And I think that's one of the clearest and most frightening demographics, is just the fact that these are single-parent household rate is going up so dramatically that, for instance, in 1990, the majority of children in the United States, the majority had at one time or another lived in single-parent home, either due to divorce or due to being born into a single-parent home. And that just says that our whole society is becoming skewed in a way that we have not known before. And essentially, we're engaged in a societal experiment that we don't know how it's going to resolve.